Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Surprise!
Are you kidding me? I was not expecting that one from Steve. We have the altered intro, which must mean we have interesting pod things happening. We do not have a guest, but we do have two parts for you. Part one, we will be talking about the NBA playoffs, some of the recent games. We're looking ahead to potential series as the Western Conference Finals might start this weekend, may start early next week. The Eastern Conference Finals is absolutely starting next week, starting on Wednesday. So we have playoff thoughts for you in part one. On the next episode, we have a full-blown WNBA preview for you, so stay tuned on that front. But let's dig into the postseason talk, Steve. Starting out East, the New York Knicks currently holding a 3-2 lead over the Boston Celtics. They won game four, 121-113. Jason Tatum was incredible in that game for Boston, 42-8-4. Also had six stocks in that game before suffering what we now know is an Achilles injury. Out for the rest of the postseason. I would imagine he's going to miss most, if not all, of next season. So naturally, sending all of the well wishes out on that front. And in game five, Boston without Jason Tatum, a 127-102 victory in game five. Derrick White knocked down all kinds of threes. Jaylen Brown, decisive, got players involved as well. Constant downhill attacks for him. Luke Kornet, what a game from Luke Kornet. Seven blocks for him in addition to 10 points, nine boards off the bench. I guess just kind of zooming out, Steve. One, gave the quick injury note on Jason Tatum. Injuries obviously stink. You don't want to see anyone go down, especially someone as good, as important, as impactful as Jason Tatum. Also on the Boston front, I'm just not sure what is going on with Kristaps Porzingis. It doesn't sound like Boston either knows or wants to publicly get into what's going on with him either. But it feels like there have just been multiple comments after multiple post games from Joe Mazzulla that kind of hints at, hey, he's trying his best. He just doesn't have much to give right now. We're trying to manage this as best we can. So naturally, we're keeping an eye on what Boston looks like moving forward. What are they able to push it to a game seven if they're able to eventually advance and face New York if this ends in six? Not sure. Hate how injuries are playing a role in this one. But looking at the game five in particular, it was a nice reminder from Boston that when we do play with tempo, when we are able to run after stops and get easy stuff, when we are able to access the paint, we can still put a tremendous amount of strain on your defense. And New York found that out the hard way. New York continued to try to lean into switching. Boston was able to ding that. They were able to get into the paint pretty quickly against New York. A lot of early transition attacks or early offense attacks that kind of scrambled New York. They also had some, it's hard to say uncharacteristic considering the Knicks just generally don't switch this much. Like, it's actually just been a story that the Knicks have ramped up the switching to this degree in the series compared to what they usually do under Tibbs. But a lot of miscommunications, a lot of, am I taking this guy? Are you not? Two to the ball. Here's an opening. Here's a drive. Or here's another three as Boston shot well from deep. And on the other end, something that I posed to you, Steve, is, hey, at what point do the Celtics consider sending two against Jalen Brunson? Because it's been a lot of switching. We want to bog things down for them. But Jalen Brunson does still have a lot of space to operate. And as we've seen in multiple fourth quarters in this series, if you give Jalen Brunson space, he feels comfortable against just about anyone. If not comfortable, at the very least confident against just about anyone you put in front of him. So it was interesting to see Boston kind of ramp up not only their help, but also just send some doubles towards Jalen Brunson. And I wonder how much of that is going to carry over into game six or a potential game seven. The Knicks can't afford for their defense to slip the way that it did. And if Boston is able to kind of disrupt the rhythm of Jalen Brunson, if you are once again dealing with a foul trouble game from Karl Anthony Towns, I still don't think, even without Jason Tatum, that the Knicks have a lot of margin for error. So I am just watching, that battle moving forward.
Why don't you think the Knicks have margin for error or don't have it?
I think there is still a lot of talent and a lot of strain that Boston could put on them. And so you need, actually, you would love to have the big Jalen Brunson games, but you need the collective effort. You need Karl Anthony Towns winning his matchups on post-ups or drives. You would like to get the requisite shot making from OG Anunoby, from Mikal Bridges, from Josh Hart. Because there is still a math element at play, Boston is still going to get a lot of threes up. Did not shoot well from deep in the earlier portions of the series. You saw what Derrick White did to kick off the game five. in particular. Jaylen Brown knocked down shots from the perimeter. Peyton Pritchard got going a little bit from the perimeter. I don't know if you want to open up things for Boston when they already kind of have the volume in their favor. If they're also generating advantages offensively, if they're winning more drives, if they're scrambling the defense more, it makes it a little bit easier for Boston to find their rhythm offensively. And I do still think Boston has, if not a flat out higher offensive ceiling than New York with Jason Tatum out, they have just as high of one with a little bit more variance on their side.
I got you. I mean, we're five games in, and the story of the series is the story of the series. I mean, I think for New York, their defense has to play at a high level, and they have to be able to contain Boston. And so that means you have to get back in transition. You got to be able to keep the ball in front. And we've seen over the last couple games, game four, game five, Boston's been able to find success with their drives, get in the paint, get pay touches, force help in a different way. Pick and roll scheme rotations a little bit different than helping on drives. Mm-hmm. And so Boston's been able to flow that way. Now you add the fact that the Knicks weren't as clean as we've seen them be in these playoffs in pick and roll, and that gave them some additional opportunities. And so that's where, for me, you got to appreciate the Knicks defense for what they did early in the series so you can understand what happens when it doesn't work as well. I think for the Celtics, it was a great team effort. Derek White came out on a mission. I thought the aggression from Jaylen Brown and Jrue Holiday at different times was really needed. Mm-hmm. I thought they had the right idea to really not just move the ball, but just try and attack, try and go one-on-one at times, try and get in pick and roll, try and get in the paint, try and move the ball. I mean, the Celtics had a series high 27 assists in game five. They had a series high 22 threes. They had six players in double digits scoring wise. They did what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And so no Tatum doesn't necessarily change their path to victory. In a sense, hey, you kind of have to move the ball a little bit more. You know, we don't have the thing that we can or have relied on to a high degree. So, you know, we have to get into our stuff quicker. We have to play with a little bit more force. And you saw just the discomfort the Knicks had at times defensively. Okay, they went stat pick and roll. What are we doing? How are we guarding this? Mm-hmm. How are we flowing into different things? But the one thing, the constant for most of the series, the Celtics defense has been pretty good.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing that, you know, it gets ignored considering how the games went as far as the comebacks. But the Celtics defense has been locked in. I think Jaylen Brown taking the Jalen Brunson matchup was very interesting. And, you know, Jalen Brunson was looking to get downhill. I thought he had some really good drives in the first half, but I thought Jaylen Brown battled. I thought Jrue Holiday battled whenever he had the cat matchup. And nothing changes for Boston as far as what they're trying to accomplish. It's going to be on the Knicks to find a way to win a game. You know, I think offensively, you've got to find a comfort and a rhythm with what you want to do and how you want to execute. And it's interesting because, I mean, the Knicks were scoring. They had, 59 points at halftime?
Yeah, tied at 59.
I was wondering, okay, who feels better? Well, Boston came out and did what they were supposed to do to start. The Knicks ended up with 17 points in the third quarter. There's your game. Mm-hmm. So can the Knicks sustain defense? Can they get Boston back down into where they're not as decisive? They're not generating the same type of shots. That's going to be their wiggle room. You know, they have to nail their path to victory. Their defense has to be at a certain level. That's going to give them the wiggle room to kind of flow, and then they've got to go out there and play. I mean, Mikal Bridges 4-14, OG 1-12. Cat had 19-8, but didn't feel like that because he's out of rhythm. I mean, Josh Hart was game, but you get a Josh Hart 5 3-point game and you lose by 25. It's tough.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think once you get to Game 6 and Game 7 of a series, we know what time it is. It's just who's going to do it. Mm-hmm.
I think on that front, just going back to the third quarter, that's where we saw the insertion of Luke Kornet. He started the second half instead of Kristaps, who, again, after the game, saw a quote. Joe Mazzulla was asked, hey, what made you go with Luke Kornet instead of Kristaps? And the shorthand was just, well, Kristaps couldn't breathe. I'm just like, this doesn't seem ideal. So, like, one, again, you just don't want sickness. You don't want illness. You don't want injury, et cetera. I do wonder, like, moving forward, do we see Kristaps, period, in game 6 and or game 7. If, you know, the effectiveness is diminished right now for very obvious reasons, but you do still have Al Horford, who I thought played well. You do have Luke Kornet, who very loud performance from him. And I think felt a little bit louder because of the contrast in like mobility in particular from what you had saw from Kristaps, if you're going with that comparison there. Like you do have other big options still. And so I do wonder if Joe Mazzulla finally decides, okay, we just need to give you time to get right, as right as you possibly can be in this postseason. And again, like, this could just end in six. The Knicks could hit the notes. They could tighten the screws defensively and get more shot making from Jalen Brunson or from Cat. And this could end in six. This may just be it. But I do wonder if we see any kind of lineup slash minute tweak on that front. Because you saw in that third quarter, wasn't necessarily a change from Boston, to your point, Steve. Like, what Boston's trying to accomplish doesn't really shift without Jason Tatum. You saw Luke Kornet on Josh Hart instead of Kristaps. And it was a lot of late help at the rim from Luke Kornet in an effort to either contest shots or we don't want you to get a shot up at all. You see an extra body, let's kick this back out. Let's funnel more touches to your Josh Harts and to some of those other wings. And Luke Kornet nailed that for most of that third quarter. Act the presence. I thought the closeouts were pretty solid. The contain on drives were better than anticipated. Like, there were two possessions off the top of my head about the 9 minute mark. The Knicks go with a double pick and roll. Jalen Brunson rejects, forces a late switch on Luke Kornet, contains as Jalen Brunson's dribbling underneath the basket, gets out to the other side. He gets rid of the ISO, and then Brunson basically gets jumped. It's like a switch and double to get Kornet out of the matchup, and then Boston's fine from there. About a minute or so later, New York goes with like a Spain pick and roll or something adjacent. Luke Kornet gets dinged with a screen from OG Anunoby. It was good stuff from him. Josh Hart hesitates a little bit on the shot, but once again, contains the drive. While this is happening, Cat is stealing Drew Holiday underneath the basket. It's a pass. Luke Kornet blocks the shot, sends it out of bounds. It's like, okay, if you can just do your job, if you can force the Knicks to think and to work a little harder and work a little deeper into the clock, as you mentioned earlier, Steve, the defense for Boston has been pretty good throughout this entire series. If you can do that and then capitalize in transition or capitalize in early offense, New York isn't able to set up some of the nuanced help that we've seen from them, even when they are switching. That just opens the floodgates a little bit for Boston, especially on a night where they're knocking down shots like that. So I do want to see if, you know, from the New York perspective, if this is just going to be a matter of let's just do things better in game six. Let's work a little bit faster, or if there's anything scheme-wise, play call-wise, et cetera, that they want to do to try to move Boston's defense a little bit.
I mean, I think Boston's defense is moving. I mean, Luke Kornet did his job very well. I thought his timing was great. When he had to nail help, he did it. He protected the rim. But you also have to look on those possessions, look at the other defenders. And it's Derek White, and it's Drew Holiday, and it's Jaylen Brown flying around. Mm-hmm. You know? So you kind of have the luxury. The Knicks couldn't get to the drives. When they went off-ball movement, the switches were there. When they did get in the paint, help was there. Mm-hmm. So Boston did what they were supposed to do defensively. And so it's on the Knicks to, okay, let's poke at Luke Kornet in the same way we poured to Porzingis. You know, this is what they're going to do. They're going to switch. They're going to try and contain the drive. They're going to help off Josh Hart. Let's put him in some scenarios where he has to get a late switch and maybe he can't help as much. Mm-hmm. Or we attack certain matchups. I think the personnel is going to be the personnel for Boston. Can you execute?
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fair. Then just quickly on the drive front from the New York Knicks, in that game four, nearly 1.4 points per possession on any trip featuring a drive. In the game five, down to 0.92, which has been well below their regular season number, well below what you would want in terms of the league average as well. You don't get that same pressure on Boston's defense. And Boston's defense, again, as you mentioned, the help was there, active and present ultimately. You don't get the same openings. You don't get the same comfort. That's why we were having a conversation during the game as it happened last night. Josh Hart had already hit, I think, three or four threes at that point. And I'm looking at the possessions where he may pass up a look of drops. Like, ooh, I don't think you can afford to do that. And it felt kind of off for me to say in real time because I recognize he's shooting well. But it's like, no, you can't. Like, Boston is already, like, funneling some of these shots to you. You can't afford to hitch because at that point, like, where else are you going with it? You're making it a little bit more difficult to you to live against this Boston defense. And so I guess beyond that, just kind of moving forward, like, do they do different things to open things up for Jalen Brunson? If Boston is going to ramp up the help the way that they did in game five, that's going to be intriguing to me. If it is going to be Cat just consistently getting, or if it's going to be Drew consistently getting the Cat matchup moving forward, does New York continue to ramp up the off-ball screening for Cat? Can you make that a pressure point? As much as you can against Drew Holiday, but can you put a little bit more strain on Boston on that front? Those would be a couple of things that I'm looking forward to in game six and again, potentially a game seven.
Makes sense. I mean, you got to match the fight. I mean, the Celtics were playing for Jason Tatum. They were playing with the fire and the life. You see that Jaylen Brown hustle play in the third quarter. They wanted this one. So now you got to go back home and try and return the same energy right back at them, send them home.
Got to do it. Got to do it. You do not want this series to come back to Boston. It's going to be a scary situation for you. Any closing thoughts on Knicks Celtics before we move?
I mean, Knicks just got to get some better twos. I mean, they were, what, 17 of 51 in that game five. And so I think finding some balance there will help them out.
There you go. The didn't feel like the middies were falling to the same degree. And again, we've both talked about the help at the rim in particular that Boston showcased. So got to loosen it up with some of those floaters, some of those pull-ups, make it a little bit easier for you. Just get some relief buckets before you can get to the juicier stuff. But excited to see what this game six is going to look like. As we transition to the West, as we have a game six later tonight, as we record on Thursday morning, the Thunder have won the last two, a 3-2 series lead over the Denver Nuggets, a 92-87 game in game four, or win in game four, excuse me. And what was, as we talked a little bit about on the most recent Young Men, the three episode with Trey Murphy, the third, it was certainly some offense from both teams. To open up that game. That's what a short turnaround will do for you. In game five, a 112-105 victory for the Thunder as well. The fourth quarters of both of those games were ecstatic. This has been a really fun, honestly, just thinking about the semifinals, at least these two series, the fourth quarters have been a lot of fun. Like, we've seen the multiple Knicks comebacks. We have seen Jokic snatch victory from the jaws of defeat in that game one in particular. Heroic Michael Porter Jr. effort in the middle of the series. We've seen Shea turn up in these last two fourth quarters, and he's certainly been looking to hit and swing for the fences with some of those pull-ups and step-backs in the fourth quarter, but those have been a lot of fun. I think broadening the scope, like, the series was about defense for me heading into this one, and as we've seen the last two games, it has just been a joy watching each defense try to gear against the opposing star. With Shea, Christian Brown, first and foremost, has just done a tremendous job defending Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in this series. And so watching OKC try to pry Christian Brown away with some earlier screens in game five was interesting to me. But in general, even if Shai is able to win against Christian Brown, he is seeing help and he's seeing bodies pretty much anywhere. And when Denver goes to the zone, which they have shifted to a lot more as the series has progressed on, it's just a constant crowd for Shai. So watching him try to figure it out as a scorer and also kind of spread his wings as a playmaker a little bit, try to find those openings, try to find those dunker spot dump downs, try to find those lobs, has been an interesting back and forth for me. And on the opposite side, the Nuggets have surely tried to move Nikola Jokic around, a conversation that we had in our recent watch party for game five of that series. Shout out to dear pal Zoe, brought up, hey, where are the off-ball screens for Nikola Jokic? Like, can we loosen him up and get him free in that kind of way? So OKC can't load up their help the way that they have. It hasn't necessarily been a high double team series for OKC, but their help has been pretty present. And they've done a good job with their early work in terms of physicality and trying to bump out the Jokic catches. If he does get a switch, we're fronting and we got help behind that. So it isn't an easy entry, things like that. We did see double digit off ball screens for Nikola Jokic in game five for the first time since, I believe, game four of the first round in their series against the Clippers. So seeing that ramp up has been fun. But, you know, zooming back out, or narrowing it back down, rather, with those Jokic post touches. Just seeing the cat and mouse of, okay, we're going to consistently put Jamal Murray one pass away because I'm tired of seeing someone in the peripheral. And Lu Dort largely hasn't cared about that. I am going to stunt and then get back out and likely contain the drive and make Jamal Murray work for openings. And if it's anyone else, aside from Jamal Murray or Michael Porter Jr., as he is also trying to play through injury right now, one pass away, oh, we could be a little bit more aggressive. It may not be a full double team unless you get into your move. And we saw a little bit more of that in game five. And it's just been fun watching Jokic try to figure out where the help is coming from, how active it's going to be, if this is going to turn into a double or not. Where are my passing windows? Where are my shot windows? How aggressive can I afford to be? And it was funny to kind of compare what it looked like early in the first quarter in the conversation that we had on that front. We get to the end of the game and Jokic just has 40 and he's hitting the somber shuffle over Chet Holmgren late in the clock in that fourth quarter. And nobody in the arena knows how he knocked that shot down with the ease that he did it in light of the defense that he saw. And so this has very much been about defense for me and who's been able to kind of solve it late. It's been OKC for the most part in these last two fourth quarters. They've gotten timely shot making in game five in particular. It felt like they went a little bit earlier, a little bit higher with some of their screens for Shea so he could more comfortably flow into some of these pull-ups since he couldn't get all the way to the rim as often as he would like to. And so I, you know, heading into game six or a potential game seven, it's just who can find enough openings and ultimately who can knock down enough open shots. Cause I'm sure Denver fans were not pleased with the amount of threes and particularly the amount of corner threes that they missed in that game five. But which star feels more comfortable seems to be the story for me right now.
The answer is going to be neither.
It's just going to be a hard no.
I mean, it's you talk about Jokic. He has to know the assignment in this one. He ended up with 44 and 25 shots. Oklahoma City's done a really good job of trusting their size with help. You know, if Hartenstein can hit Jokic, that's fine. If Jokic is on the post, they're going to come from the baseline. You know, can they get him in the middle of the floor? Can he force help that way? Can they move him around the chessboard? But he's got to score. I mean, Denver's formula is going to be Jokic scoring and Jamal Murray has to score. They have to be aggressive and they have to go out and play and keep that pressure on them. Denver's defense has to do enough to give them the opportunity. And so you look at kind of the first half, it was a good sign for Denver that, okay, we can score and our defense is still going to give us a shot to play. You go up, what, 56-49, you look up, it's a different score at halftime, it's 56-54. That's huge. And now what are you reestablishing? How are you winning this? What can you do? So if OKC can kind of figure out the zone and kind of figure out the man and feel comfortable about things, you put yourself in a tough spot. So they're going to have to come out, and that's going to be their playoff formula. Jamal Murray, Jokic, y'all have to play our defense. We have to find enough between drop at the level zone to just keep you in a box and get ourselves where we need to be. I mean, if you go back to the game four, where OKC was able to close it out, I think the interesting part was Denver was really comfortable with that zone. Alex Caruso started setting screens. Denver was like, fine, we can't play zone. Shea gets a high pick and roll, gets a basket. That's the game, pretty much. And so that, to me, lets me know, okay, can OKC do enough to crack what Denver wants to do defensively and open things back up? Is Denver going to come out and score the ball in a way that's going to make, you know, OKC maybe play a little quicker or get into quick shots or not have the same automatic rhythm? That's going to be the back-and-forth battle. I mean, I think it can go either way. If I'm OKC, I'm trying to make sure Jamal Murray doesn't hit me in this game. And I'm trying to get Jalen Williams going and Chet going and let Shea do what Shea does. And they're just going to have to create and play. I mean, because Denver's help is going to be Denver's help. The zone's going to be the zone. They've got to play with aggression. They've got to play and execute with purpose.
And I think to that end, as you mentioned, like you want to get Jalen Williams going, you want to get Chet going. I'd say just on a very basic note, probably a little bit easier to get Jalen going with some of the uses that he's going to have. Like, I think they could replicate a lot of the early draft screens that Shea got for Jalen Williams, whether he's on the floor with Shea or when you get into some of those hybrid second units. The Chet piece is where I am intrigued to see, like, how can they get him going? Because I'll just say kindly that Denver has felt very comfortable defending Chet Holmgren in this series. He has not been, not that he hasn't had good moments throughout this series or hasn't been able to score in key moments. But in terms of how much attention we want to shift to Chet, Denver hasn't really been on that portion. Like, they've been willing to stash smaller players on Chet Holmgren. And even if they don't, if it is Aaron Gordon or someone getting the matchup, okay, we can just turn this into a switch and then not really worry about what happens after that. And so I do wonder at what point, if at all, OKC decides, okay, if you're going to put Jamal Murray on Chet, or if you're just going to be willing to switch Jamal Murray onto Chet, can we get Chet a couple of early touches before Denver loads up their zone? Can we get to a cross screen or something with Chet, or just an early pick and roll, Chet dives? Can we maybe play the get Jamal Murray in foul trouble game early to establish Chet and also put a little bit more strain on Denver if you do get some body blows on Jamal or a couple of early fouls and kind of disrupt things? Because as we all know at this point, this isn't a super deep Denver Nuggets team. This isn't a deep rotation for them. And so I wonder if that's going to be an avenue, because Chet, guards kept, he's had some pretty solid drives sprinkled in throughout this series. It's not like this has not been, at least in my opinion, a deal of Chet being like afraid of contact or anything like that. He's certainly trying to dish it out and he's trying to absorb it. It just hasn't always been, it has always gone well from a result standpoint for me. And so, like, if we're looking for silver linings, that's an encouraging thing to me. it hasn't felt like he's been overwhelmed that he's shying away from contact. He does just have to win those more. And if Denver is willing to put smaller players on him, it is on Chet and a little bit on OKC. Okay, let's get him some touches. Let's see if we can actually win some of these. And if he's able to win one or two of those battles early, what does that do for Denver? What are the downstream effects of that? That's going to be interesting. For Jalen, it feels a little more simple. Again, you can replicate a lot of the uses that Shea is getting. You don't want the same volume unless he's cooking, but you can do a lot of the same things with him. And it just becomes, okay, how many of these pull-ups will Jalen make? How often can he get to the line? How many early attacks can he sprinkle in? If he wins enough of those, OKC is in a pretty good spot. And so, like, that's kind of where I'm looking in terms of the OKC offense. For Denver, I feel for him. Like, the Jamal Murray portion is obviously important. And, you know, as much as I've enjoyed what OKC has at least attempted to do against Nikola Jokic, like, popping from game one onward has been, oh, if you go flat spacing and you try to get Jamal Murray a little space to flow into pull-ups or whatever, depending on who's spaced in the corner, who's spaced in the dunker, we'll still step up and show that help. We'll be in a drop, even if we start a little bit higher up. And as Lou Dort or Cason Wallace or whoever gets the Jamal Murray matchup based on the time, as they try to navigate, we'll keep that big up a little bit and then drop back, or we'll just have him purely in a drop and we have an extra help defender coming in. And to Jamal's credit, we have seen him knock down quite a few contested pull-ups because he's that kind of shot maker once the postseason rolls around. But I would imagine that kind of help, that kind of hounding, that kind of pressure has to weigh on you at least a little bit. And so I'm curious to see, like, what game six and game seven Jamal Murray is going to look like. I know from a competitive standpoint, he's going to be game. He's not shying away from the moment at all. They need him. He just had, 28? And his game five did not shoot well. But that's also the point. Like, he kept firing. But again, the OKC has done a really good job of making things tough for him and making him not necessarily think, but he just doesn't have the same airspace. And so I'm curious to see, like, what that part is going to look like moving forward.
Fair.
So that part is going to be fun. I'll say quickly on the shout out portion. Quick shout out to Lou Dort. Just a shift of results in game four compared to game five. Was not shooting well. Certainly wasn't afraid to take shots, open or otherwise, in the game four, but just did not have it from the perimeter. OKC ends up closing with some of their bench mates in that game. Went a little bit smaller, 1-3. And then you get to the game five, where OKC's battling back after Denver took the early lead. And here's back-to-back-to-back three-pointers from Lou Dort in the fourth quarter to bring them within two. Before eventually Shea makes big play after big play down the stretch. Just want to salute Lou Dort. For one, he has been defending his tail off this entire series, trying to hound Jamal Murray at the point of attack, occasionally being switched onto Nikola Jokic and battling there, in help, trying to play that balancing act between staying attached to Jamal Murray when he is spaced one pass away from Nikola Jokic and providing some kind of presence there. It's not an easy job. And then also have shots funneled to you, just in general, but in particular when Denver goes to as much zone as they have. And so for him to have that shooting performance in game four, ultimately not close that out, and bounce back in game five to hit those big shots, it's a testament to his willpower and just his ability to step up in a big moment. So I didn't want to get past this segment without shouting out Lou Dort on that front. I would like to see Isaiah Hartenstein find the push shot again. It feels like once the ESPN broadcast noted how good he's been on that shot, he just stopped making them for multiple quarters at a time. So we'll see what that effectiveness looks like, because I do think in light of the switches that Chet is seeing, Isaiah has been kind of their best option in that dunker area in the middle of the floor to kind of counter what Denver's doing help-wise or within that zone. And if he doesn't have that shot as a counter, it does get a little murkier. Not even just a little. It just gets murkier for OKC in the half court if he isn't able to give them the relief bucket. So keeping an eye on that shot in the game six and potential game seven as well. The natural, which version of Russ are we going to get? Didn't feel like he was like particularly awful or anything like that in the game four, game five, but he has been better earlier in the series. And in light of, again, Denver not having the deepest second unit right now, they do need him on both ends of the floor. I feel like the defense has been solid. The rim pressure has been important. We'll naturally keep an eye on the shooting and the finishing for him. But I think that does it for me in terms of Thunder Nuggets thoughts. Did you have anything else that you want to point out? Scheme things, anything you're looking forward to in these next two potentially?
Win or go home is always fun.
That it is. That it is. Okay. Well, with teams potentially going home soon and very soon, we'll stick out west. If the Thunder are able to take care of business either later tonight or in a game seven, they will face the Minnesota Timberwolves, who just knocked off the Golden State Warriors on Wednesday night during the regular season series. Two games apiece for both. 113 to 105 back in December. Then three games in February, a 15-point win for the Wolves, a 7-point win for the Thunder, and then the overtime win for Minnesota that probably shouldn't have been a win for Minnesota considering how big that fourth quarter lead was. If you remember, it was pretty much Minnesota's second unit that erased like a 20-point lead in the fourth quarter, eventually forced overtime. Minnesota's able to get that one done. If we do get that series, that is the likeliest option right now for the Western Conference Finals. I do wonder, on a general note, like we've talked a little bit about culture shock on this podcast before for playoff series, but how did the semifinals prepare each of these teams? I don't think Golden State's defense is as good as OKC's, but smaller players that are comfortable plugging gaps as helpers, mixing in the timing of help, like those are things that OKC does. Like that kind of concept is replicated in OKC. With different personnel, naturally. So, like, with Anthony Edwards in particular, seeing that kind of layered help and seeing that kind of nuanced help at the rim in particular, does that prepare him for what he may see against OKC? And for the Thunder, after facing this Denver unit that has collective size up front, that has Nikola Jokic, like, what does the defense look like in this series against Minnesota? That's a little bit different. Like, you have a different pressure point in Anthony Edwards. They're attacking in different ways. How much easier isn't the right word to use. But because it's going to be different for both sides, like, who's going to benefit the most from how different these series may be would be my initial general question heading in.
What do you think is the biggest difference between this series for these teams?
I think for me, like, it's a different level of half-court execution, I think, that OKC is going to have to deal with. We're talking about their defense. I think Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic just put a very specific amount of strain on you. And as good as Anthony Edwards is, and as good as Julius Randle is and has been in this postseason run, it's not the same pressure. And so, like, that may alter what kind of coverages they try to go to against those two in particular. And so, like, that would be an early difference for me on the defense front there. The Minnesota one is a little bit more interesting for me because you start the series with Steph and then he goes down. It's more Jimmy Butler, naturally. Jimmy Butler and Jonathan Kuminga. That feels more like just a ramp up in volume and pressure in that ordeal because Jimmy Butler, should be noted, was not 100% or really close to it in this series against Minnesota. And so dealing with the constant drives from Shea, from Jalen Williams, dealing with these bigs in particular, I think it's going to be a little bit of a different challenge for Minnesota. And so I think it's just going to be a little bit of an adjustment period for both.
What I would say is the question will become, which version of Anthony Edwards does he want to be? In the sense that when he has the playmaking, the scoring going, he elevates Minnesota. And so you anticipate there's going to be some activity in pick and roll. But for OKC, we only really have to show that attention to maybe one person in pick and roll. So can we drop? Can we help? What type of help do we want to show in Anthony Edwards' isolations? For Minnesota, probably going to have to guard in a little bit of a different way. I thought their defense was really good against Golden State. But against Oklahoma City, are you ready to take away their automatics? Are you ready to defend and keep the ball in front? Mm-hmm. Are you ready to defend against cutting? So OKC has some of the things that Golden State tried to work towards without Steph. But that's just kind of what they do.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to get back in transition. You're going to have to get ready to guard. How does Julius Randle handle the size? How many different people does OKC think can guard Julius Randle? Do they try and put a wing on him? Do they go with pure size? They try and mix things up. Can he maintain that aggression? Because they need his drives to be able to play at this high of a level and keep pressure on teams. That's kind of where my eyes are. I'm curious as far as what Oklahoma City would choose to do and if Minnesota can adjust to that. I think for OKC, they're going to have to deal with a team that has size defensively. How does Minnesota want to handle OKC's offense. How many people do they think can guard Shea? How many switches can go in there? What's Rudy's primary coverage going to be? Can they protect the paint? How are they going to be able to mix things up to kind of get OKC in the mud? That's probably where my mind goes first.
Oh, I think that's fair. Like, I think to the OKC offense point, quickly, like it kind of blends into their defense because this is going to be a different series in terms of, again, going from Nikola Jokic to Anthony Edwards. It's just different stylistically. And I do wonder if OKC is able to set the table a little bit more, or set the tone rather, a little bit more defensively. Does that unlock more of the transition attack that they, outside of game five, they really haven't been able to get to consistently? Like, are they able to get more half court stops? And does that open up more of the easy stuff for them? And can they kind of unlock that kind of that snowball effect that we saw more so during the regular season for them, to where, okay, we're forcing turnovers. We set our defense. We force a stop. We get an early one. We now get to set our defense again. And now you're just in an uphill climb if you're the other team. Like, do you get more of those kind of stretches for them is going to be interesting to me. And I'm glad you brought up the Julius Randle point, because that feels like, as I am always kind of locked into, ooh, what are the player matchups going to be heading into this series? That feels top of mind for me. Because there is a world where, hey, we don't trust that Julius Randle is going to shoot like that. Let's put Chet on him. And the natural counter there would be, well, Julius Randle is just going to put his shoulder into Chet's chest, and Chet's not going to have a good time. You could go with Jalen Williams against Julius Randle. We have seen Jalen Williams guard up and down a positional spectrum this year. We've seen Jalen Williams get some of the Randle matchup this season. There may also be a world in which Julius Randle is able to just put his shoulder into Jalen Williams' chest. And what does that open up? If you go with Isaiah Hartenstein, just from the strength aspect, that makes sense in terms of the post-ups. But then does that open up some of the handoff or the pick and roll usage for Julius Randle, who is more than willing and able to run those? Do you get into just, in general, it could be 4 or 5 pick and roll. Maybe that opens up some stuff for Rudy, because Julius is willing to hit him. If OKC is going with switching in particular, he's willing to hit him on some of those slips. Do we just get into some inverted pick and roll and we're going to make Isaiah Hartenstein navigate? I think OKC will have some help points that they're comfortable with to kind of crowd the paint, but that does still present an opportunity for Minnesota to open some things up. And I think general theme for Minnesota is that when they play with the appropriate tempo, or if they feel like we can find opening somewhere, they have the guys to puncture tilted defenses, no matter how good that defense is. Like, we have seen a really good Jaden McDaniels in throughout pretty much this entire postseason for that very reason. I am not afraid to take shots from the corner. I am not afraid to drive immediately and get all the way downhill and get into some of these Euro steps and some of these weird fading jumpers that he's been able to knock down. He's cool with that. Mike Conley, very quick attacker when the ball swings to him. We know what Anthony Edwards can do against a tilted defense. And so what the matchups are for Julius Randle, how much help they want to show towards Julius Randle, because I do think on the other end, regardless of who gets the matchup for Randle, if OKC feels comfortable just defending him one-on-one and they're not going to open up those catch and drive opportunities off of those Randle post-ups or ISOs, this does look and feel a little bit different of a series for me, at least. It becomes a little bit more difficult for Minnesota to really puncture OKC's defense. And so I'm curious to see, like, how they're going to land on that front. That was a question that I had heading into this series with Denver. Like, how often would they double? What kind of help would they show towards Nikola Jokic, especially in light of how great of a passer he is? Julius Randle's a bully on the block and a really good passer. He's not Jokic. So, like, does OKC feel a little bit more does that mean they feel more comfortable sending help because they don't think Randle can puncture them in the same way as a passer? Or because he's not the ridiculous scorer that Jokic is, and he ultimately hasn't had a great post-up series so far, do they send less help and say, yo, Julius beat us? If Jokic didn't, then you're just going to have to show us that you can. That's going to be a fun cat and mouse for me when it comes to Julius Randle. His usage to kind of help he sees the matchups that he sees. Like, that just feels like a real swing factor in the series.
Battle's going to be who can get who in rotation first, yeah, and who can do it consistently. I think that would not be surprised if OKC decided to throw multiple things at Anthony Edwards just to try and stay away from the automatics. As far as, we're not going to let you get a rhythm. This might be a switch. It might be drop. Might be a trap. I wouldn't be surprised if Minnesota mixes in some zone and kind of has some different lineups. You know, we can go Naz Reid and Julius Randle. I think it's whoever's able to win the drives is going to be key. Because I think if either team has a defense where we can work to keep you in front, that can bog you down. But if we're able to drive and force help in that way, that opens things up. So I think that's going to be probably the most fun thing to see, what the attempts are to kind of get downhill and force help. And can Minnesota kind of tap at the activity button that OKC likes to hit sometimes? You know, do you want to double Naz Reid in this post matchup? Do you want to double Julius Randle in this post matchup? Does that affect some of your lineups that you play? Where can we poke at you? How many people do you want to guard Anthony Edwards? Like, so on and so forth. I think that's where it gets fun.
On that note, Steve, who would be your X factors for this potential series?
Probably for Minnesota, they need Jaden McDaniels and Naz Reid to play at a high level. They need Jaden's defense. They need him to be aggressive. And they need Naz Reid to be someone that OKC doesn't feel comfortable guarding, and he needs to hold up defensively. I think that's probably a big key for me. The Thunder, I mean, Jalen Williams. You're going to have to show up and show out, and it feels like an Alex Caruso series to me.
Oh, man. Alex Caruso versus Anthony Edwards seems like a really good time. Or because it's Alex Caruso, he is also going to, I would imagine he's going to spend at least a little bit of time on Julius Randle in some of these smaller lineups, whether just getting that matchup outright or Randle cross match in transition, some off ball switching, et cetera, et cetera. Alex Caruso is going to have his hands full, as he generally does. So that's a good one. I like that. I think for me, one, just a broader note before I get back into the X factors, like, I do wonder if this is just going to turn into fourth quarters here, both teams are small. Or both teams just have a singular, quote-unquote, big on the floor. The Julius plus Naz lineups in the front court are going to be really interesting to me. Because I think because OKC, especially if it's like Hartenstein doesn't have it or Chet has a foul trouble game, et cetera, like, once they do downsize, there are a lot of players that, at least in theory, Julius Randle or Naz Reid are going to feel comfortable driving or posting up. Which, again, circles back to your what kind of pressure point are those players going to be, what kind of help are they going to see, et cetera. I do also kind of worry about, like, what the defense looks like in a series with those two. Like, does that just open up more driving and cutting comfort for OKC? Like, that's also going to be an interesting battle for me. How often either one of those teams want to go small, honestly, because it feels like I could see a world in which Julius Randle and Naz Reid, they just bully folks. And OKC's not having a good time. They're kind of forced to play more too big than they would like to. There's also a world in which Shea is like, oh, cool. Rudy Gobert's not on the floor. I am getting to the basket over and over and over and over again. Same thing for Jalen Williams. And does that kind of force Minnesota into bigger lineups versus having that lineup versatility and having that kind of balance they can flow into either one? So I'm curious on that front. As far as X factors, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, for me, at least in the non-starter division, since Jaden McDaniels is a really good one. We've talked about how important Julius Randle is going to be in this series, et cetera. Nickeil Alexander-Walker, he's going to see some of the Shea matchup. I would imagine he also sees a little bit of the Jalen matchup in some of those hybrid second units that we get there. And as reductive and as simple as it is, I just kind of need him to make shots because I trust that the defense is going to be there. He can't be a very obvious help point or someone that OKC is comfortable funneling shots to, and missing those threes leads to some of those longer rebounds and some of those transition opportunities. They just need him to have the impact on both ends of the floor. He's clearly good enough. He's been one of the best reserves in the NBA for the last 2-3 years. It would be helpful to get a two-way impact series from Nickeil Alexander-Walker. And for OKC, I land on Lu Dort for similar reasons. Like, he's going to be trusted to get tough defensive assignments. I would imagine he starts out on Anthony Edwards in this series, if it happens. Can you defend Ant without fouling? How many of those illegal screens are you going to draw because you're fighting over and hitting the turf? But naturally, he's going to be helped off of. Can you knock down enough shots? Can you win enough drives? It's going to be a sneaky one for Lu Dort as well. So those are probably the two that I have outside of, like, the starting bigs. You mentioned Jaden McDaniels, Chet, Julius Randle, all guys. They're going to play big roles in this one, but I think that's where I ultimately land. Who do you have winning this series if we get it, Steve?
Wolves in six.
Ooh. I like the Wolves pick. I think that's fair. I probably go OKC in six, but probably trust the offense a little bit more. And I think this is going to be a different slash. This feels like more of a Chet slash Isaiah Hartenstein series than this one does right now. I would go OKC in six, I think, if we get it. But to the flip side, if the Nuggets are able to win game six, and able to win game seven, we would have Nuggets Wolves. during the regular season series, the Wolves swept all four games, did have some pieces missing during the regular season matchups. Similar deal with OKC and Minnesota, had key players out for most of those matchups. But regular season sweep for the Minnesota Timberwolves. Heading into this one, one, I would just be incredibly annoyed if I was Jamal Murray, because what do you mean? I start my postseason with Chris Dunn, and then I have to deal with Lu Dort and Cason Wallace, and then I have to deal with Jaden McDaniels and N'Keal Alexander-Walker again. And if we remember last postseason, it was their length and activity and screen navigation, in addition to, hey, what if we just decide to go full court pressure on top of all of this? And so, again, because Jamal Murray is the ultimate competitor, I certainly don't think he's going to back down or be scared or anything like that. But from a physical standpoint, as the minutes have had to ratchet up for him and many of the Nugget starters in light of what their reserve unit is, seven against the Clippers, seven against the Thunder in order to get to a potential Western Conference Finals, into this series against Minnesota, is he physically ready for that kind of series and that kind of workload? He is going to be very important for Denver, as he always is. But like, that is just that's such a wild group of perimeter defenders to have to deal with in one postseason run. And so I do wonder what Murray looks like on that front. And as we saw a whole lot and have seen a lot of Denver zone, like, do they press that button again against Minnesota, who have had their own struggles against the zone when they've seen it during multiple regular season games, even outside of this particular matchup? But how much zone do we see? Can Minnesota counter it quick enough? And beyond that, naturally, what is going to be the base coverage for Denver this one? Do you go two on the ball against Anthony Edwards, who, as you've noted many a time, Steve, if Ant knows what's coming, especially when it's two on the ball, he doesn't mind getting off of it and putting your defense in scramble mode. How much drop can they play against Anthony Edwards, which would then naturally lead into how many pull-ups is Ant going to hit and things like that. And then just kind of eyeing a matchup very quickly, like Julius Randle versus Aaron Gordon just seems like a matchup that's just going to hurt as a basketball fan. Aaron Gordon can just muscle you with his drives, the occasional post-up if he sees a small defender, him lurking around the dunker spot. That's going to be fun. And we know what kind of drive-heavy style that Julius Randle has. And if those two are matched up against each other, that's just going to be a lot of fun. I would imagine that gets chippy at some point. So I'm just excited to see that one, ultimately. But as they are very important pieces to their teams, who can have more of an impact would just be my baseline question heading into that one. I think that's where I would start with Wolves, Nuggets.
I mean, I think in this one, it would be up to Denver to find the defensive versatility, because if Anthony Edwards is comfortable against two on the ball, he knows when you're going to go to drop, and he can attack some matchups at times, that kind of keeps him as a pressure point. And he comes out and plays a certain way against Denver. You know, you don't really have to worry about the blend of playmaking and scoring against the Nuggets. For some reason, he's just locked in. I think for Minnesota, it would be the defense. How many late switches can you get in? Who are you helping off of? And are you just kind of giving Jamal Murray the drop and take the space? Well, late switch, we'll be good to go. Obviously, containing Jokic the best you can, but we feel comfortable with our ability to keep the ball in front and show help, and we're going to just allow you to kind of make these kicks to everyone else. So I think the battle feels, for me, more on Denver's side to be able to find the defensive versatility and then be able to get their team going to take advantage of Minnesota's defense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think other thing I would add, as the non-Jokic minutes are always a bellwether for Denver, if they're able to hold serve or occasionally win them, then they feel really good. If they get blasted whenever Jokic goes to the bench, that is obviously a problem. As the postseason has progressed, like, this has very much just become, okay, Aaron Gordon, you are a backup five. Like, we've experimented with a little bit of DeAndre Jordan. Aaron Gordon, you are just a guy. It's you. It's going to be Jamal Murray. We're going to surround you two with whatever we can. Sometimes it's MPJ. It's kind of a three-starter unit. Sometimes it's Christian Brown. Sometimes that's some kind of a three-starter unit. It may just be you two plus three bench guys. That Denver second unit with Gordon at the five versus Nas at the five, if that's what we get, or if we get Nas plus Randle in those minutes, like, those are going to be very important swing minutes that I think that'll be worth keeping an eye on that front. And I would also say, going back to the starting group in particular for Denver, obviously when you had Karl Anthony Towns, you were able to go with Kat on Jokic, and then we just have Rudy Gobert roaming over. We've seen a lot more just Rudy on Jokic during the regular season matchups between the two. I do wonder how often, if at all, Minnesota wants to press the cross match button with Jokic, I don't think it's going to be the same just from a size perspective, but can you mix that in for a handful of possessions just to give Jokic a different look? In addition to like whatever help you want to try to layer in or what kind of double teams you want to layer in. Just general scheme slash post defense versatility against Jokic is something that I'm keeping an eye on as well. But who would be your X factors in this potential series, good sir?
Mike Conley for Minnesota should have a chance to make some more plays against Denver's pick and roll coverages. Mm-hmm. And for Denver, I'd go Russell Westbrook. They would need his force, his drives, his defense to kind of take them over the hump.
I think that's fair. I think for me, you keep an eye on Rudy Gobert, who, again, if he's going to see a lot of the Jokic matchup, he is going to have to hashtag do his best against that guy who, no matter how good the defense is for Rudy Gobert, Nikola Jokic doesn't seem to care all that much. And so can you hold serve enough? Can you stay on the floor? Just from a foul trouble perspective, if you get a couple of early body blows from Jokic and it's two fouls, and now Minnesota has to play small, that obviously shifts some things. Not that Minnesota couldn't wade the waters there, but it at least makes the path a little bit more difficult. So they're going to need Rudy. And naturally, offensively, if he does see some time against Aaron Gordon and some of the smaller lineups, can you win enough of those possessions on the offensive glass? Can you get some of those late passes, catch the ball, and finish at the basket? That's going to be important for him. And then Christian Brown, if we are setting Michael Porter Jr. to the side, because naturally, I would like for his shoulder to work so you can get the full breadth of the shooting, at least more consistently. Like he had the game three, I believe, with 21 points. And I don't think he's been in double digits since. Like he's very clearly laboring. It just, if this was the regular season, he would not be playing at all. So a quick hat tip to him for the toughness, but very obvious injury caveat. Like if he's healthy enough to burn Minnesota from deep when he gets those opportunities. But I go Christian Brown. After coming off of defending Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, you will now have to deal with Anthony Edwards. They will need the defense. They will need the random screening, especially if they want to sprinkle in more ball screens from Nikola Jokic and invert things in that way. The cutting's going to be important. The three-point shooting naturally is going to be important. Just an important two-way piece for Denver. So we'll keep an eye on what Christian Brown. I do love the Russell Westbrook shot. Clearly Denver's best reserve and can provide some legit juice on both ends of the floor. Who would you pick in this series, Steve?
Wolves in six.
Okay. Oh, this is boring. I would also pick the Wolves in six. Like this just feels more like one, Minnesota is just very good and deep. And I like the line of versatility that can tap into. I'd be excited for Anthony Edwards in this series. So like, I do think Minnesota is a better team. There's also the element of back-to-back seven-game series with a short rotation and one of the players in your short rotation has an arm. Like at a certain point, like Nikola Jokic is good enough to do this. Jamal Murray is good enough to do this. But if we're talking about what's more likely, at least in my opinion, like at a certain point, you just kind of reach your wits end, I feel like. Like I think this is where, again, I think Minnesota is a deeper roster in general, so I could make the case anyway. But it's that plus this has just been a lot for Denver. And I'm not sure if they have enough, especially if this does get to like six or seven somehow. Like, I just don't know if they sustain enough. I think if Denver wins this series, it'd have to be early. This would have to be Nikola Jokic taking charge very early in the series. Like, it feels like Nuggets in five if they're going to do it. But if this gets to six or seven, I think I just trust Minnesota because they're a little bit deeper. I'd say official Minnesota in six for me. But okay, swinging to the East very quickly. Close out the NBA section. The most likely Eastern Conference final series that we get, which again, start next Wednesday, would be the Indiana Pacers taking on the New York Knicks. The Knicks won the regular season series 2-1, only three games between these two teams. Mitchell Robinson did not appear in either of these games. Two of these games were played before Christmas, or before Thanksgiving, rather. And the second was played just after the trade deadline. And that was the game that the Knicks won, but there was no Miles Turner in that one. And I think for me, my questions begin with the Knicks defense. One of the pleasant surprises for me, as we talked a little bit about earlier in the pod, was that the Knicks were willing to switch as often as they did. As we've seen in the first two rounds of this postseason for the Indiana Pacers, they seem pretty comfortable against switches. Pascal Siakam likes seeing smaller defenders. Miles Turner has done a much better job of punishing small defenders, either with post-ups or offensive rebounds. Tyrese Halliburton is just boogieing and dancing on the perimeter when he sees a big. I don't know how much switching New York can get to in this series. Or at the very least, that feels like a swing for me. if the Knicks do it, how often are they going to do it? And then within that, how effective are they going to be? Because if they are able to hold up in the switching, this becomes a very interesting series. If they cannot, what is going to be your base coverage? Do you want to have Cat at the level, which I have historically said on this pod, I like him more at the level than I do at a drop. If that's the base, do you want to give the Indiana Pacers of all teams two on the ball or a big at the level and open things up? If it is drop, can the Knicks sustain enough in the drop? Will the screen navigation be good enough? Like, this feels like, at least heading in, this feels like this would be more Mikal Bridges on Tyrese instead of OG Anunoby. But actually, because they're that good, you can go either way on that front. So that would be a lineup or a matchup question that I have. Who gets the primary Tyrese assignment? But if you are going to go drop, boy, is that screen navigation going to have to be good. And boy, is your help going to have to be principal. Because as we've talked about in particular, like, the Pacers move well off the ball. They'll relocate naturally. They will cut if necessary and remove help, especially from the nail. They will sprinkle in these flare screens, particularly with Miles Turner setting them. They're going to have to be locked in. And so for me, it is just, what do the Knicks land on as a base? Obviously, in an ideal world, they're able to mix in drop, they're able to mix in at the level, they're able to mix in some switching and have varying degrees of success in all three. But what is going to be their base and ultimately what is the execution going to be like? That is where I start with this series. Because if the Knicks defense is not game for this one, the Indiana Pacers, they have just proven in the calendar year 2025, but they have proven in this postseason, one, we do just have answers for every coverage, but if you stick with something that we're comfortable with, we are going to bury you. And so I start with the Knicks defense in this one.
I mean, the beauty of the playoffs is the questions start to remain the same to a certain degree. I think for the Knicks, you go back to the Boston series, do they have enough defense to sustain? What do they want to do? I think the switching aspect is one of the things I highlighted. Are they going to be able to switch? Will they want to switch? The story of the playoffs has been how much of a machine the Indiana Pacers have been. Milwaukee can never find a coverage that made the Pacers uncomfortable. They carved up, drop, switch, two on the ball. Cleveland did the same or fell to the same fate in a way we didn't expect. But I think for the Knicks, you're coming off series against Boston. Now, you don't want to be in rotation against Indiana or Boston. You want to contain the drive. Now, the only difference for the Knicks is going to be the fact that tempo is guaranteed for Indiana. You're going to bog them down, or at least the hope is you're going to bog them down with switches, but they're not going to stop moving. So you are going to have to defend on top of the switches. You're going to have to keep the ball in front. You're going to have to be able to make sure you recover. The Pacers can put you in rotation. That's always been the tough part for the Knicks defense. That was my concern in this Boston series. If the Knicks can switch and stay out of rotation, they give themselves a chance. If the Knicks are not clean with their defense, if they're messing up switches, if they're not locked in, that opens way too much up for the Indiana Pacers. So I think the defense point is fair. I would imagine the Knicks would just try and work on either switch and drop, try and alternate between those two and live with the results. But it's going to be interesting. I think for the Knicks, what's the right tempo for them in this series? You're going to have opportunities to play a little bit. Do you want to go too fast? Do you want to go too slow? You can kind of put yourself in a box against the Pacers in particular. There is a world, though, where do we look at the Knicks and do they find comfort in this series? It's funny to look back at the regular season. And again, you can kind of see the difference in Indiana's defense with their physicality because the Knicks tried to use Jalen Brunson off ball a lot to get him movement. And he was free to move, unlike what we saw the Pacers do to Cleveland Cavaliers where they took movement off the table. Mm-hmm. But you look at, statistically, Jalen Brunson against Indiana this year, 22-7, 53% from the field, 50 from three. Cat against the Pacers, 30 points a night, 12 rebounds, 56% from the field, 46.7 from three. OG, 19.5, 57% from the field, 50% from three. Mikal, only 11, but 50% from the field, only 20% from three. And Josh Hart averaged 22-10 against the Pacers. 62.8% from the field. Mm-hmm. So this is a different Pacers defense. So some of that could just be rubbish. But are they coming off a series where, hey, we played Detroit. They did this very specific thing. They were active. They were physical. Cool. Hey, we played Boston. They did this very specific thing. They were physical. They were active. They were switching. Hey, I know you guys have been doing this very well in the playoffs, but you're not either of those two teams. We don't respect you the same way. Mm-hmm. And do they now, are they able to kind of feel a little bit of freedom offensively? Or is Indiana able to kind of take things off the menu and make things tough? And, you know, how many people do they think can guard Brunson? How many people do they think can guard Cat? If you flip to the Indiana side, that's where it can get interesting. But that's where I'm intrigued. If Brunson and Cat can win their matchups, they can force Indiana to help, they can switch and keep Indiana in front, that's probably the Knicks' path to victory. For Indiana, you gotta poke at the Knicks' defense. You gotta make what they want to do untenable, and then you gotta be physical on the other end. Make them play slow. Jalen Brunson, you're gonna get what you get. Cat, you get what you get, but none of it's gonna be comfortable, and you run away with it.
As much as pace is gonna be important, and we know Indiana likes to get up and down, they want to press you full court and bother you. We know how important transition can be for New York, a selective running team, but they are super impactful when they get out there. The physicality is really going to pop in this series, I think. The Pacers, particularly in these most recent series against the Cleveland Cavaliers, but the Pacers do not mind putting their hands on you. Again, the full court pressure pops, but even off the ball, like we're going to grab, we're going to hold a little bit, we're going to make you work for this stuff. And that's especially what we've seen over the last 2-3 months for them. And so as you kind of alluded to, Steve, like this feels like a different Pacers defense than some of these regular season matchups. Yeah, like these two teams have not played each other since February 11th. Second matchup, you didn't have Andrew Nembhard or Aaron Nesmith, as we're talking about Jalen Brunson defenders. They didn't have Nesmith in the opening matchup that they had back in October. And so now entering a series where, again, this Pacers defense has been very good for a while. They have been super physical throughout this postseason. You now have Aaron Nesmith and Andrew Nembhard to kind of oscillate between on the Jalen Brunson matchup. Jalen Brunson is really freaking good, so he could still just win those matchups. But like, I wouldn't pencil that in as a win. Not saying that you are, but just as a general note, like, hey, this may look a little bit different for Jalen Brunson. And I think the full court pressure thing in particular is interesting to me because of how generally effective it is for Indiana. But I do wonder, because New York is willing to sprinkle in a screen at half court or a little bit higher, and Jalen Brunson loves just running down a sideline and kind of going into like a back down from 25 feet anyway. Are the early attacks for Jalen Brunson opened up in a different way in this series? And if so, and in light of how crafty he is, what does that mean for Indiana's guards? Like, I think it is going to be annoying, and we're not really going to talk about it on the pod because we don't like doing ref talk collectively. But I would imagine the whistle and how tight or loose it is going to be an early conversation point for a lot of folks in this series if it happens. Because it is either going to be, how on earth did Jalen Brunson get that? Or why is Jalen Brunson not getting anything? And I think the tenor of those conversations might tell a story as to who's dictating terms on that front. So that's something I'm going to be keeping an eye on for sure. And trying to think beyond that, like, I'm glad you brought up the Cat numbers in particular, because this feels like one of my questions I broke down. It's like, hey, does this feel like more of a Cat series? Do you just get more pops if Miles Turner is the assignment? If it's Pascal Siakam, how does he feel on post-ups and drives against Pascal? He is bigger than him. Still, Pascal's still pretty big enough, like big four, et cetera. But does Cat just feel more comfortable? And I'm really curious about like the pop portion. Because I don't know how often Indiana is going to switch some of the Brunson Cat stuff, depending on who gets the Cat matchup. So is that just more pick and pop for him, or pick and pop and then drive? And is New York able to get Indiana's defense scrambling in a different way? Like, I think Cat could really drive this series, figuratively and literally. So probably overqualified for my X factor, but star division, like, he feels like a really big swing. Jalen Brunson is their best player, but I think Cat can really open some things up for New York's offense in a way that we haven't really seen, at least not consistently, in the Boston series. But beyond that, trying to think, is there anything else I want to hit on? Just quickly, this is a point that you've made before, Steve, so nothing new, but how aggressive is Tyrese Haliburton going to be to start some of these games? If it is switching, is he looking to attack, or is he looking more to feed the post or kick it somewhere else in kind of space and allow the other Pacers to play 4-on-4? Just what is the early mindset going to be for him? We know he's good enough to win against bigs in space, or just win in general, but just how early is he looking for a shot is of interest to me. Those are probably the major things for me, at least heading in. Who would be your X factors in this potential series?
Miles Turner for the Pacers.
Where have we heard this before?
And the wings for the New York Knicks.
And again, where have we heard this before? But no, that makes sense. They have their jobs cut out for them. I think for me, I have just the Brunson defenders in my notes between Andrew Nembhard and Aaron Nesmith. Can they bother Jalen Brunson? Can they bog down New York's offense? Can they navigate well enough? Can they do so without fouling? That's going to be the important part. And naturally, if they're left open, what kind of shot making are we going to see from Andrew Nembhard in the series? How many threes is Aaron Nesmith going to hit? So natural two-way questions there. And then Mitchell Robinson, who did not play in any of these regular season matchups. He has been very good defensively throughout this postseason. He is and remains a monster on the offensive glass. So if we're talking about winning the margins in this series and getting extra possessions up, like naturally turnovers are going to be big, but offensive rebounds will be too. And I don't know if Indiana copies Boston and say, hey, let's go hack a Mitchell Robinson. Let's slow you down, not let you get into anything. But because we're comfortable pushing off of makes and stuff anyway, we can still get to our tempo. If we do get hack a Mitch from Indiana, very basic analysis here. Mitchell Robinson has to knock down his free throws. Largely did that in game five. It just ultimately didn't matter because Boston was just flowing elsewhere. But we'll keep an eye on Mitchell Robinson. Steve, who would you have in a potential Pacers-Knicks series?
Knicks and six.
Okay. I think I may go Pacers and six. If the defense is going to be that good, like I just trust their offense to generate advantages in a way, or at least more consistently than New York. And obviously, I can end up wrong on that front because New York is very good. And as we talked about, this could just be a very different series, a different context for them offensively. And so we may see more freedom from Jalen Brunson and Cat in particular. So certainly not out of the question that the Knicks win it. Have a little bit more faith in Indiana right now. So I would go Indy in six. And finally, if the Celtics are able to win game six and win game seven, we would get Pacers-Celtics with the Celtics having home court advantage. Naturally, no Jason Tatum. In this series, if it happens, we will again keep an eye on what Kristaps Porzingis' status will be, whether that's going to be he's starting low minutes, he's coming off the bench, or we're just not playing you for a little bit as you try to recover. So that serves as a very obvious health wild card for the Boston Celtics. But during the regular season, my favorite thing in the world, Steve, as you know, we've talked about on the pod before, is cool. This may be a series or this is a series. Let's go back through the regular season matchups. Let's see what it looks like. All three of these games were played before New Year's Eve. We have not seen Celtics Pacers in the calendar year of 2025, where notably the Pacers have been very good. The Celtics have also been very good, but they're also going to look very different. And this is on top of multiple Pacers defenders missing during these regular season matchups. But the Pacers did win the regular season series 2-1, if you care about that portion. So outside of the very obvious, I don't know what Kristaps is going to look like, etc., this feels very much like a Boston balance series offensively, and they're going to have to make good decisions. They are going to have to balance playing with tempo, getting into some off-ball movement, poking at some things, getting Indiana's defense moving, and, hey, Tyrese Halliburton, come here. Hey, TJ McConnell, solid defender, but you're smaller. You come here. Hey, Miles Turner, you've had a good year. Let's test you out in space, etc. How they're able to balance their general tempo, their general movement with the mismatch hunting is going to be important. Because this is not a series, as does this sounds, this is not a series that Boston can afford to bog down in. And that would have been the case for me if Jason Tatum was still healthy. Without Jason Tatum, they absolutely can't afford to bog down and get stagnant. And let's take 8 seconds to get the matchup we want and then dribble in place and then try to attack. Not that they can't still win those possessions, but that doesn't feel like a consistent style that would bode well for them. They have to find the right balance offensively and find the right tempo offensively. So I think I'll start there with Boston. And then from the Indiana perspective, again, whenever they saw switch from Milwaukee, they had fun. When they saw switch it from Cleveland, they had fun. Boston has different defensive personnel than both of them and can also cross match in a different way than both of those teams. And that's with Jason Tatum out still, which I will quickly say that Jason Tatum deserves a lot of credit for what he is defensively and what he means to Boston's defense and how much of the switching and cross-matching he opens up. It will be different for Boston, but it's still good and it's still different from what the other two teams, the Pacers, have faced in this postseason, what they provide. How Indiana deals with Boston switching is going to be interesting because if they're able to ding that too, margin for error increases for Indiana. The amount of ways they're able to ding Boston's defense and ultimately keep pressure on them and improves for Indiana, and that naturally improves their chances of winning the series. So I think that's where I would start with Pacers Celtics. What say you, good sir?
Does Boston have enough offensively and defensively to keep the Pacers in the box? Can they find the drives and put pressure on Indiana's defense that way? Can they nail the switches and get Indiana in the mud? I don't think there's a lot of wiggle room for Boston in this series without Jason Tatum. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to rely on getting Indiana to play a specific way, and that's very hard to do. So I think for the Indiana, it would just be do your job. I think you nailed a lot of it. But for Boston, you got to find enough to make this competitive.
Got you. I think this is going to be, again, like in general, you want to make good decisions and play with the appropriate tempo. Like this very much feels important for Jaylen Brown in particular, because I think if you are going into the mismatch hunting bag, he's very well equipped to win in the way that Boston needs him to win. I am putting my head down. I am getting to the line. I may finish through contact anyway. So like those possessions where he may get Tyrese Halliburton on the switch, as we've seen sprinkled in through the series with Boston, with New York, excuse me, they'll use Jaylen Brown as a screener or set up some random post-ups for him. If Boston taps that button, can they use Jaylen Brown as a screener to get Tyrese, and can they flow from there? If he has Andrew Nembhard, who is a really good defender, I think an all-defense caliber defender, don't think he ends up making it this year, but he is that level of defender. He is still a little bit smaller than Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown's incredibly strong. Can Jaylen Brown win enough of those with the drive? So glad you brought the drives in particular on that front. But yeah, I think you're right on it. Like Boston's going to have to flow offensively, and they're going to have to hold up well enough defensively. And if they don't, Indiana can run. And on the flip side for Indy, this Boston team can still move it. And this Boston team will get a lot of threes up and can knock down a lot of threes. And that's where Indiana defended very well against Cleveland. But Cleveland also didn't shoot at the same level. I think Boston has some shooting upside that Cleveland, similar to Cleveland for one, and Milwaukee, I just don't think they really had in terms of the overall shooting upside on that front, despite the regular season percentages for them. There are just a lot of guys for Boston that can run hot. So that part gets interesting for me. Who would be your X factors in this one, Steve?
Miles Turner and Drew Holiday.
Ooh, that'll do. That'll do. Drew versus Tyrese should be fun. I'd imagine we get a little bit of Drew versus Pascal as well. So that could be interesting. I wonder how often we see like Drew on Miles Turner. Like, do they test out for Indy? Like, do we test out a Miles Turner post up? Or is that something they're just like, okay, absolutely not. That is bait. I am not taking that. I am not doing that. No. But that would allow Boston to lean even more into their switching. So interesting back and forth there if we see that. I love the call, Steve. For me, looking at the second units, one, I think TJ McConnell versus Peyton Pritchard is just going to be a lot of fun. TJ McConnell is going to drive everywhere. Peyton Pritchard will shoot from anywhere. Both of those guys feisty at the point of attack. And I would imagine whether that's Pascal, maybe that's Tyrese sometimes. And from the Boston side, if that's Jaylen Brown in particular, may look at that smaller guard and say, hey, you come with me. Can you keep me out of the paint? And so how they hold up defensively is going to be important. And in general, they impact offenses in different ways. But who's going to win out is an interesting battle. Obi Toppin in this one intrigues me. It's always, if you are going to switch with that second unit, or if you're going to go activity-based with Thomas Bryant at the five, how well is Obi Toppin going to hold up when he's directly attacked, or what are the help instincts going to look like? Because if he is late, Boston will get into some swing sequences. And I don't know if Indiana can afford for Boston to win some of the like the non-Jaylen Brown minutes in this series if we get it. And naturally, Al Horford going to play a big role defensively in this series. If he starts, I would imagine he's going to get a good bit of Miles Turner in this one. May spend some time on Pascal. If not the outright matchup, then some of the transition cross matches and things like that. It's going to have to knock down shots. The screen is going to be important to pry open your Derek Whites, your Drew Holidays, your Jaylen Browns, etc. Al Horford is always game in the postseason, but he is going to have to produce on both ends of the floor. Steve, who would you have in a potential Pacers-Celtics series?
Pacers in five.
Ooh, in five. Spicy. I've been back and forth on this one because, like, I think, especially with Jason Tatum, I think Indy's a better team. But Boston does have some things to poke at. I think I go Pacers in seven in this one. I think we get a long one. But that concludes some of the early look aheads. Again, Eastern Conference Finals starting on Wednesday. Western Conference Finals may start Sunday, may start Tuesday. We will see. but wanted to get some quick thoughts there. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot online watch parties. The link is in the description if you want to watch some playoff hoops with us, talk about some music, talk about some wrestling, whatever randomness we want to tap into. The link is in the description. It is free to create a profile. No shenanigans. Come hang out with some awesome people and enjoy the sport that we all love. Also, if you aren't subscribed to the Young Man the Three YouTube channel, you want to do that. We've been hooping it up with Pelicans wings Trey Murphy the Third early in the week, talking some playoff hoops. Had a recent episode talked about the draft lottery as well. And naturally, there's just great content dropping on the channel throughout the week. So you want to be subscribed to that anyway. But if you want more of us, you can catch us there. And with that, we will catch y'all later.
Julius Randle's pretty good.